On this week's podcast extra, a bonus episode from our friends at the United States of Anxiety, produced right here at WNYC. They released it on September 11th, and that's kind of where their story starts. Kai Wright is the host with reporter Matt Katz.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
You're listening to Ibad Rahman lead evening prayer at New York University, and I think it's gorgeous. I first heard the dancing lyricism of prayer in Arabic way back when I was in school myself, and it never fails to put me at peace. But clearly, not everybody hears peace in these sounds. Ibad is a PhD student in religion. He's basically spent his whole life studying Islam.
My parents immigrated from Bangladesh, and we grew up in a religious household where we were encouraged to pray, where we went to the mosque. After sixth grade, elementary school in the Lower East Side, we made a trip to Mecca and Medina when I was 11 years old. For my family, we all became more devout and more concerned about learning about the faith and taking it more seriously.
But he says, like a lot of people, he really got serious about understanding Islam following 9/11. Every person who was in New York City that morning has a story about it, can tell you exactly where they stood when the reality of it sunk in. Ibad was at Stuyvesant High School, just a few blocks from the World Trade Center.
I was in Mr. Grossman's European literature class in 10th grade on the sixth floor of the library, and Mr. Titel, the principal, comes on the loudspeaker, and everyone rushes through the windows, and we see the smoke coming.
Now, teenage Ibad had already started dressing in a way that reflected his culture.
You know, wearing a long garment, and I was visibly Muslim.
And that's important to his 9/11 story, because it's a story about how we perceive one another.
We were evacuated and we walked up by the West Side Highway, and there was a group of Muslim students who banded together.
The school had a strong and really diverse association for Muslim students, and one of the older kids took charge.
A student 2 years ahead of me who thought it would be good to stay together and look after one another. Because the trains were shut down, they were trying, many of them lived in Queens. I lived in the Lower East Side, so I broke off from the group and just walked home.
Ibad sort of regretted that. He later heard what happened to his friends while they were hanging out, just waiting for a way back to Queens.
People were saying, look at those Palestinians celebrating, about this group of high school students of my peers. I later thought, you know, I should have invited them over to come to my place. I didn't know what the day was looking at, and I was out of touch with my family, so.
It was a small thing, really. A random jerk, somebody who passed by and instead of seeing a bunch of nervous teenagers on a really crazy day, saw traitors, terrorists, a vaguely defined but clearly anti-American other. Still, it was plain to even George W. Bush that this kind of misperception, bigotry actually, it had to be checked. It was counterproductive. So just 6 days after 9/11, he became the first president since Eisenhower to visit a mosque.
The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace.
16 years later, obviously a lot has changed.
I think Islam hates us.
How'd this happen? How'd the prejudices of a few become mainstream political thought? Since we ended this series, the president's travel bans on refugees and on visitors from a list of Muslim countries have taken effect. And on this 16th anniversary of 9/11, fear of Islam is a defining part of American politics. So in this special bonus episode of the United States of Anxiety, Culture Wars, we talk to the man who, in many ways, set the stage for Donald Trump. I'm with WNYC reporter Matt Katz, who took a deep dive on conservative media for us back in season one of this series. Go back and check it out if you missed it. And Matt, you say there's very clear data on the change in perceptions of Muslims among people on the right, at least.
Yeah. According to Pew, the year after 9/11, 47% of Republicans thought at least some Muslims were anti-American. Pew then checked again this year, and that number among Republicans is 63%. American hearts on the right have hardened toward Muslims.
So how does that happen? What does that tell us? Is it that we've sort of had this building slow response to 9/11 that's only now crescendoing?
Yes, but the thing is, it didn't just happen naturally, and that's why I want to introduce you to a man you've probably never heard of. His name is David Yerushalmi.
I was in Israel at the time, just outside of Jerusalem, on my phone, talking to my father, God rest his soul.
Yerushalmi is an American lawyer, a New Yorker, who was living in an Israeli settlement on September 11th, 2001. He was on the phone with his dad in Florida at the very moment that the planes hit. They've got the TVs on, they're watching this together like everyone else in the world, and Yerushalmi immediately says to his dad,
"We got it wrong.
We got it wrong." Yerushalmi was galvanized. Now, at the time, he thought terrorism was primarily about nationalism. Remember, he was living in Israel, and it was just a fight over land as far as he was concerned. But after September 11th, Yerushalmi decides it's not economics or politics causing terrorism, it's Islam. The religion itself, and it needs to be stopped.
And I immediately packed up the family, came to New York and said, this is where the debate is going to be, here and in Washington, D.C.
I met Yerushalmi at a Starbucks in a hotel lobby near Kennedy Airport right after he got off a red eye from California. It was early, we were tired, so I bought Yerushalmi a cup of coffee, black. His hat read, American Freedom Law Center. That's the name of his nonprofit, which he uses to mount legal battles, mostly about Islam. And that's exactly what I wanted to talk to him about.
The women decided not to move. When they were asked to leave, they refused to leave. When the police came, they finally were forced to leave.
He's talking about a group of Muslim women in California whom he's suing. Yerushalmi's a lawyer who travels the country fighting what he sees as Islam's steady encroachment on the American Judeo-Christian way of life. Yerushalmi's been involved in conservative causes for years, but after 9/11, he just dives into the politics of Islam. He studies with Islamic scholars in the West Bank to learn classical Arabic so he can read and analyze the texts of Islam himself.
So we looked at the classic sources and found that these terrorist modern-day sources were simply quoting and abiding by classic sources. And you could find a historical pedigree that was continuous.
Now, he doesn't have a degree in this, and he won't talk about who exactly he studied with, but he says he understands the legal framework of Islam because he's an attorney, and as an Orthodox Jew, he's a scholar of Jewish Talmudic law. So after several years of studying, he believes he develops an understanding of just how Islam and Islamic law works. Now, 5 years on, 2006, he had a piece in a conservative publication calling Islam America's greatest enemy. And that's when he started his first think tank on Islam, Society of Americans for National Existence.
Okay, so he knows right away. He's not like posting a Twitter rant or just blowing off steam. He's really dedicating his life to this, to, I guess, a jihad against jihad.
Yeah, he's playing the long game, and the long game was changing public policy. So first, he proposes a 20-year prison term for adherence to the violent jihad precepts of Islamic law. Now, that didn't go anywhere, but he started coming up with other ways of stopping Islamic law from taking hold in America, like he said it had in so many other countries. He repeatedly refers to these polls taken in various Muslim countries where most respondents said they should be governed by Sharia, or Islamic law, and that scared him.
It didn't matter whether they spoke Urdu, Farsi, Arabic, Chinese, Russian, Croatian. They all said the same thing. They said, we're driven by our law. Our law, Sharia, says that everyone must submit to Allah's will.
So the next thing Yerushalmi did is figure out how many Muslims in America think our country should be run by this foreign Sharia law. In 2007 and 2008, he hired undercover researchers, spies, these sort of secret agents who went into 100 mosques around the country. They peeked at the ancient texts on the shelves to see if they contained calls for jihad. They observed whether the women were wearing hijabs. They chatted with the imams and took notes on their style of beards. Then all of this research went back to Yerushalmi, Shami, who determined that, ready for this, more than 80% of American mosques are what he called Sharia adherent. Yerushalmi got his findings published in a peer-reviewed academic journal, and this stat, this 80% stat, began to get cited in conservative publications. Breitbart.com's headline read, 81% of U.S. mosques promote jihad. And then it began to be used by activists on the streets opposing Islam's role in America, like, for example, when it comes to the construction of mosques.
The controversy over Park 51, the proposed mosque and Islamic community center, is not dying down. Politicians and
2010 is the inflection point. This is when the conversation about Muslims in America really began to change. The proposal to build the Park 51 mosque and community center just a few blocks from Ground Zero drew outrage from conservatives.
What would happen, do you think, if the Ku Klux Klan wanted to establish a memorial at Gettysburg? They wouldn't get to first base. Nobody would put up with the Klan building a memorial anywhere, much less Gettysburg.
And that mosque was never built.
No, it wasn't. It was the first big victory for what became known as the counter-jihad movement.
I mean, are the Islamophobes.
That's what their opponents and many civil rights activists call them, but they describe themselves as counter-jihadists. They are self-described experts in Islam, like Yerushalmi, who see this civilizational war on the horizon. And this Ground Zero mosque fight was just the beginning, because it gave birth to a whole slew of other controversies.
You're watching the Pix News at 10.
It's not just a planned mosque near Ground Zero itself that's generating all kinds of disagreement concerning the Muslim faith. Tempers are now flaring over a bus advertisement so disturbing, the MTA has, up to now at least, refused to run it.
To be fair, though, it's not just Yerushalmi and his band of so-called counter-jihadists, you know? I mean, Americans really did have legitimate fears, still have legitimate fears about terrorism. We can see that around the world there are terrorist attacks happening. And people see Islamic jihadists on their TVs, they're killing Westerners. And it can't be said that Yerushalmi is just manipulating them.
And Yerushalmi does not take credit for turning America against Islam. Instead, while we were sitting in the lobby of this hotel drinking coffee, he pointed up to a TV where CNN was playing.
So you're sitting in airport, you're home watching CNN, you're home watching CBS, and the entire Middle East is imploding.
Terrorist attacks by Muslim extremists in Europe, two unpopular wars where Americans continue to get killed by Islamic radicals.
Daniel Pearl of the Wall Street Journal gets his head cut off. Another building gets blown up. Then there's an attack by a so-called lone wolf in the United States. And CNN and CBS are telling you it has nothing to do with Islam. Close your eyes. There's no threat. Don't worry about it. And people in the world that have common sense say to themselves, that doesn't ring true.
We know there's a threat. There's a debate about how much of a threat, but we know it exists. And the country is dealing with it militarily, spending billions on wars and counterterrorism efforts and surveillance of our own people. What more does he want us to do?
Ban Sharia law. Ban the implementation of Islamic Sharia law in American courts and governments. He believes there is something fundamentally violent about Sharia. And ever since he did that survey that said most mosques are Sharia adherent, this has been a chief concern of the counter-jihadists. A radical Muslim way of life is infiltrating American governments and courts. When I talked to Yerushalmi, he explained how this creeping Sharia, that's what they call it, he explained how it works.
Your concern then was that this Sharia and then a possibility of a caliphate could take hold in the United States, that Sharia could be implemented in a way where a caliphate was a real potentiality?
No, and that's always the kind of caricature, right? Do I think that the United States is weak enough to collapse either from a a kinetic jihad, meaning war, or even a civilization jihad that the Muslim Brotherhood talks about? No, at least not in my lifetime. But do I think it's an existential threat that allows for sleeper cells and the internet-grown jihadists that we see day in and day out wreaking so much havoc here and in Europe? Yes. Do I see it as a threat to our freedoms and liberties incrementally through their so-called civilization jihad, meaning the nonviolent form where they use our laws and our freedoms to undermine our laws and our freedoms? Absolutely.
So let's stop for a minute and talk about Sharia. There is a raging debate right now between the counter-jihadists on the right and American Muslims about what this word Sharia really means. I met Corey Saylor. He's the director of the Department to Monitor and Combat Islamophobia for the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. CARE is a Muslim civil rights group that Yoram Shami is suing. He believes they're a terrorist affiliate. Regardless, I met Saylor at a mosque in Edison, New Jersey, where he was running a seminar for local Muslims on Islamophobia, and I asked for his definition of Sharia.
What I would assert to you is that violent extremist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda share one thing with the U.S. Islamophobia network, and that is they have the same twisted interpretation of Islam. My understanding of Sharia, if you boil it down to its two key goals, is be a benefit to humanity and avert harm from humanity.
Now, it is true that Muslim Americans can get civil rulings on contracts, divorces, and wills from religious judges who use Sharia teachings in their decisions. And government courts can affirm those decisions, but the same kinds of courts or tribunals or judges exist for Jews and Catholics. And I asked Yoram Shami about the Christian and Jewish Bibles. They talk about stoning a woman on her wedding day if she's not a virgin. But he told me while some Muslims may be okay, don't be fooled by that, because Islam, as it's predominantly practiced, is fundamentally dangerous.
Maybe there's this noble and peaceful Islam, because I know the Muhammad who lives next to me, and he's a wonderful man, and he has a wonderful wife, and the kids play with my children. Clearly, his Islam is noble and peaceful. But you know something? There's another world out there that's not noble and peaceful, and they do it in the name of Islam.
So in 2012, Yoram Shami tried to preemptively stop Sharia in the U.S.
Wait, so how do you preemptively stop Sharia? I mean, who was trying to implement it in the first place? Was that even a thing?
I've often had this same question, like, is this a solution in search of a problem? The case most often cited of Sharia taking hold in America involves a judge who did not grant a restraining order to a woman who was sexually assaulted by her Muslim husband. The husband said he was just abiding by his religious beliefs. Now, the ruling was overturned by a higher court because it was, you know, a terrible ruling. There are no other cases like this that I could find, though. But Yoram Shami is not taking any chances. He would say otherwise you're being naive and only thinking about the short term. So he wrote a draft bill that he called American Law for American Courts. And it forbids judges from enforcing Sharia if it conflicts with the Constitution. And then he worked with other counter-jihad groups to promote it to conservative legislators around the country.
And did they go for it?
A version of Yoram Shami's anti-Sharia bill has now been introduced and debated in most states. A dozen states, by my count, as of last week, have so far made it into law. And of course, it's helped to have allies in the media, shows like Fox and Friends, priming the pump.
Sit down for just a second. Sharia law is alive and well in Texas.
So as this is happening, as Sharia law is being debated in Republican-led legislatures, really in the middle of President Obama's time in office, another movement is brewing in America.
In case you haven't noticed, government spending is out of control and people are angry. So what are they going to do about it? Well, how about have a party?
After 8 years working on this issue, studying Arabic, publishing research papers, picking fights in New York City, finally, Yoram Shami had an opening to mount a national campaign against creeping Sharia.
All around the country this Wednesday, people will be holding symbolic tea parties to protest our government's tax and spend attitude.
Yes, the Tea Party was supposed to be about economic issues, and at first it was, taxes and Obamacare. But there's only so many Tea Party meetings you can hold on the national debt, so soon enough, fighting fanatical Islam became a Tea Party cause. Counter-jihadists reached out to Tea Party activists online and at conferences, and they turned the Tea Party into an ally. The Tea Party was this activist vessel ready to be filled with counter-jihad ideology. So soon enough, Tea Party websites had screeds about Sharia. Tea Party events were headlined by counter-jihad activists like Pamela Geller, who gained this national profile after winning the Ground Zero mosque fight. Geller went to a Tennessee Tea Party meeting to warn that the Muslim Brotherhood had infiltrated the Pentagon. This meeting was jam-packed. People, mostly old white people, were jumping out of their seats, very excited.
We are at war. We are at war, and I tell you that the information battle space, the war of ideas, is where the real war is fought and where the subsequent blood and bullets and bombs are a result of that war. And I ask you to be a soldier for freedom. And you can't sit back anymore. Those days are over.
Now, Yerushalmi wasn't at the meeting. I don't think he ever spoke to a Tea Party meeting. He's a behind-the-scenes guy. He's got this big, scraggly beard in the style of his Orthodox Judaism, and he spends far more time on overnight flights to different parts of the country filing lawsuits about Islam than he does in TV or radio studios. But the stats, the allegations, the quotes that Geller and other camera-hungry counter-jihadists use, they all came from Yerushalmi. He created fodder for them, like suing bus companies that won't run anti-Islam ads and suing the Treasury Department for bailing out supposedly Sharia-friendly AIG and suing an Arabic language school in his hometown of Brooklyn. These suits create the headlines and the controversies that gave his allies fodder for the speaking circuit. He partners with counter-jihadists who go on talk radio, Fox News, Christian TV, and Facebook. Counter-jihad DVDs get distributed for free by conservative groups. Counter-jihad books hit the New York Times bestseller lists. It just gets in the ether, and before you know it, somebody else picks up on this counter-jihad thing.
I'm starting to wonder myself whether or not he was born in this country.
So it's not going away in your mind. Donald Trump, who we all know was born in this country, all you have to do is read the side of his building. Donald,
which one?
Yeah, I know, many of them.
The Obama birther controversy was at least in part about a disdain for his dead father's religion. And toward the end of Obama's first term, Fox and Friends was giving tons of oxygen to this Donald Trump-fueled controversy. And so this stuff that had been on the fringes gets woven into mainstream Republicanism, and that's when the 2012 Republican presidential candidates began invoking some counter-jihad rhetoric of their own. Newt Gingrich, who was once allies with Muslim Americans, suddenly announced that he would only put Muslims in his presidential administration if they renounced Sharia, or, you know, Islam itself. Things heated up the following year when influential Christian leader Pat Robertson went on the Christian Broadcasting Network and called out the Islamic religion.
It's almost like it's demonic that is driving them to kill and to maim and to destroy and to blow themselves up. It is just, it's a religion of chaos.
Now, by Obama's second term, Islam's evils were explored from all angles on conservative media. Muslim Americans participating in honor killings, Muslim Americans practicing female genital mutilation, and the most outlandish, Muslim American no-go zones. By 2014, conservative viewers were learning about towns where non-Muslims and police could not go. Here's counter-jihadist Martin Moyer on Fox News exposing terrorist training camps in the no-go zones.
They teach them how to kidnap people, how to strangle them, how to kill guards, how to do guerrilla-type warfare training. And this is what goes on in these isolated no-go zones inside the United States.
And in 2015 came Clock Boy.
Breaking tonight, growing controversy over an event unfolding at the White House right now. Ahmed Mohammed, the high school freshman detained by police for a project that his teacher thought was a fake bomb, is celebrating the second annual White House Astronomy Night.
Ahmed's father, Megyn Kelly reported, had ties to Muslim war criminals. So should Obama have brought him to the White House? For many on the left, Ahmed's story was a cause celeb, a Muslim kid getting busted for a science project, proof of just how extreme the right's fear-mongering over Islam had become. Then the story for the left went away. But for the right, It kept going. At one point, Yerul Shami himself got into a legal battle with Clockboy's family. By now, conspiracy theorists in the Republican coalition took up the counter-jihad cause. As the 2016 election season neared, Alex Jones, one of then-candidate Trump's favorite radio hosts, warned about top Hillary Clinton aide Huma Abedin.
Huma Abedin, the admitted Muslim Brotherhood mole, but over here she can dress in fancy dresses and, you know, hang out with Hillary Clinton in the same hotel room.
The other half of America probably didn't even know Clinton's assistant was being labeled a Muslim terrorist. But congressional Republicans demanded answers, because Yerul Shami's once fringe movement had become a central tenet of Republicanism. When counter-jihadists talked, Republican politicians listened. In 2015, Republican presidential candidate Trump showed up at a Capitol Hill rally organized by the Center for Security Policy, a leading counter-jihad group where Yerul Shami is the general counsel.
Our next guest really doesn't need much of an introduction. Businessman Donald Trump.
Yes, REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It really was Trump's entrance music. It's fitting because Trump made the same argument Yerul Shami does. The battle against radical Muslims is an existential war, and political correctness prevents us from fighting it properly.
The best way to keep foreign terrorists, or as some people would say in certain instances, radical Islamic terrorists, from attacking our country is to stop them from entering our country in the first place.
The counter-jihadists are running the country now. Attorney General Jeff Sessions once got the Keeper of the Flame Award from Yerul Shami's Center for Security Policy. And Kellyanne Conway, who led Trump's campaign, did a poll for the Center for Security Policy that determined 25% of Muslims supported violence against Americans. Of course, it was an internet survey criticized for its methodology, but no matter.
Most recently, a poll from Center for Security Policy released data showing 25% of those polled agreed that violence against Americans, these are people that are here, by the way, people here, 25, not 1%. By the way, 1% would be unacceptable. 1% is unacceptable. 25% of those polled agreed that violence against Americans here in the United States is justified as part, think of that, as part of the global jihad. They want to change your religion. I don't think so. Not going to happen.
Matt, who is paying for all this?
Surprisingly, much of the counter-jihad movement is paid for by billionaires living in New York City. There are almost three dozen groups in the counter-jihad movement that have collected at least $60 million in donations. Yerul Shami is affiliated with about a half a dozen of them. And the donations help Yerul Shami pay for those cross-country flights to courthouses around the country to fight radical Islam. But he won't talk about that money stuff.
Who are the deep pocket donors?
Well, I'm not going to provide names. And you know, if anyone who donates more than $5,000 $5,000 or more to a 501c3, that information is kept private.
I should note that these counter-jihad groups, or hate groups peddling Islamophobia, as the Center for American Islamic Relations and the Southern Poverty Law Center describes them, they're all designated nonprofit charities, 501c3s. So using 990 forms, I was able to look at one of the donors who has given hundreds of thousands of dollars to Yerul Shami link groups through the years. This is the Alan and Hope Winters Family Foundation. And similar to a lot of the money behind the counter-jihad movement, Alan and Hope live in the Upper East Side, and Alan directed a hedge fund in the Cayman Islands. But there are some surprises here. They seem to hang with liberals. Alan is on the board of University Settlement in New York, which serves the poor and immigrants. He once took a few years off and taught public school in the Bronx. I sent him an email and a certified letter, and I even got hung up on by his accountant. They wouldn't talk.
Here's the pressing question of our political era. Is there any way to bridge the chasm between Donald Trump's most ardent supporters and those of us who truly believe his ideas and rhetoric are dangerous. Sometimes I think maybe there is. Our shared frustrations with economic inequality, unaccountable elites, endless war. But listening to Matt's conversation with Ural Shami, I'm sobered. Matt asked him about research showing just how remote of a threat terrorism is to people living in the U.S. His answer revealed a worldview that is just hard to negotiate with. To Ural Shami and those who have taken up his cause in the years since 9/11, our borders are more than political and legal boundaries. They sort life into a pecking order of value, those inside and those outside.
There was a stat from the Cato Institute, 1 in 36 million chance of an American being killed by a foreigner, and that includes the period of 9/11. And then NBC News took it and said you have a higher likelihood of getting buried alive than being killed by a foreign terrorist on American soil. I think the opponents look at that, just look at the odds and look at the stats and say, you know, there can be no other reason for this other than bias.
Well, that can certainly be a perspective. I would disagree with it. My disagreement would be as follows. Someone in Syria who's not a passport holder or a resident alien or someone holding a visa, someone in Syria or Iraq or Germany or Japan has no right to come to this country. We allow them to come because we welcome immigrants as long as it's done in a way that's legal and safe. I value the life of that one U.S. citizen, that one out of, what was the number?
36 million.
I value that one life more than I value the desire of all of these people to come to this country. Now, what we need to do is take rational steps to protect that one life.
United States of Anxiety Culture Wars is a production of the narrative unit of WNYC News and WNYC Studios. Matt Katz reported this episode. The narrative unit team includes Reniqua Allen, Rebecca Carroll, Paige Cowett, and Patricia Willits. Casey Means is our technical director. Hannes Brown is our composer, and our theme was performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Andy Lanzett is our archivist. Our digital team is Lee Hill, Diane Genty, and Jennifer Hsu. Jim Schachter is Vice President of News for WNYC. Jessica Miller is the Narrative Unit's producer. Karen Filment is our editor and executive producer. And I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for listening.